Dugan. We're going to bring up 125. Then we have the land transfer from railroads in the state of Alaska on the calendar. So we'll continue with public testimony on HB 125. This time I'll turn it over to Vice Chair Frentlove.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Mr. Fox, are you online? Mr. Fox, we were rushing you to close. Would you like to complete the testimony you had presented, an answer to one of the questions that had been posed before, and you were getting ready to continue on with the second point?
Yes, ma'am. My name is Dale Fox. I'm the president and CEO of Alaska Char. And I just have a couple of last comments to make, and I'll close off quickly. We also need to look at enforcement issues and look and see if we think anything it will be diminished there. And, you know, for many, many years since statehood and before, there was significant cooperation between local police, the ABC, and the state troopers. And there still needs to be. All of those agencies are necessary for making sure that we enforce Title IV issues appropriately. And picking up the phone from one agency or another doesn't make a difference in any significant way. In fact, the Budget, Legislative, and Audit Committee that spent a lot of time on this issue this summer concluded that HB 125 does not restrict or change the enforcement responsibilities of the board or the Department of Public Safety in any significant way. Because there are already separate divisions working on separate issues. Bootlegging is primarily handled by the state troopers. ABC and local police need to cooperate, but they're all over the state. Obviously, picking up the phone is part of that game. Then the issue was brought up earlier today about, well, we understand that currently the ABC has two former police chiefs and a former state trooper in the top three positions, and we articulated that that's not conceivable that enforcement would diminish. And there was a speaker earlier that suggested that perhaps that might change in the future. I would suggest that it won't change significantly in the future because the enforcement positions particularly are virtually required to have an enforcement background. Things like carrying the guns, you need the gun training offered in enforcement. So further, grants that for compliance checks, the ABC is not allowed to spend those monies on other activities they shared with us. So we expect that the enforcement efforts to continue at a robust rate. What we do believe changes under the Department of Commerce is that the Department of Commerce helps businesses with licenses understand, they help educate, they help with training, and they help licenses do better. And as I mentioned earlier, we're the best in the nation at refusing service to minors at licensed premises. That doesn't mean there's not an alcohol problem with youth. There is. But they're not getting it primarily from licensees. They're getting it from other sources, and we need to attack all of those issues. So, in conclusion, for many, many years, the ABC was not administered by the sky will not fall, and enforcement will continue for many years to come. Thank you, Ms. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Fox. Are there questions from committee members? Thank you, Mr. Fox. There are no questions. Just for the clerk, we have a full complement of the Finance Committee, Representative Hawker, Costello, Edgman, Dugan, Jewell, Guerra, Wilson, Guttenberg, myself, Representative Fairclough, and co-chair Representative Thomas. We're just a little bit out of sorts. We do have before us the CS for House Bill 125, Labor and Commerce, an act moving the Alcohol Beverage Control Board to the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development. With that, we'll continue public hearing. It is the request of the co-chairs that after we conclude that we set this bill aside instead of further debate at this point, and to move into our afternoon agenda. So with the support of the committee, that's the direction of this particular bill to continue. With that, Baleen Cook. Baleen, are you online?
you for listening to my testimony and also earlier this morning. I am, as I mentioned before, currently on the ABC Board of Directors, and I am here to testify today against House Bill 125. I will give several examples on the time that I've been on the board, what I've seen, and please bear with me. I will give you an example of when the ABC Board of Directors went to Nome for one of our meetings, and that will be 2 years ago in September. We always have public comment. And Ms. Cussy Towler from Nome, I'm not sure she has a response. Pardon?
Ms. Cook, someone was
I'm
just...
I'm not sure she has a restaurant or a liquor store. She thanked us for having the ABC Board of Directors meeting there in Nome. And she further went on to say that she appreciated the compliance checks and she took pride in having the compliance checks, and that when the compliance check was done, she took pride in posting that she had passed her compliance check. So I would like to use that as an example that not all establishments feel that the ABC board is out to get them. Furthermore, when we went to Kotzebue, when Kotzebue voted to go damp, we had our board meeting there. It was in September last year. And Kotzebue decided to have a local ABC board similar to what we have. And we had many of their members speak at the public comment period of how the ABC board staff had helped them, our director as well as enforcement, and helping them come up with ways to run their new situation of basically having an area where they could sell alcohol. And one of the comments from one of the members was that it was very nice to call the director and actually get to talk to her in person instead of leaving messages. And we also got to see how it was run after our meeting. The other example that I would like to, or not example, I have talked to community members here in Cordova and other parts of the state that have contacted me, and they are concerned that if the ABC board is moved to out of public safety to Commerce, that the perception will be that with it not being in public safety, that they will not have the same type clout. They're concerned also that underage drinking will go up and that the communication will just not be as well taken care of as it is now. And I do have one quick request that please call them compliance checks, not sting operations. I feel that that is disrespectful. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Cook. We do have a question. Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My only concern in looking at this bill is where the ABC board will be more effective, and what I still don't have a grasp of is the interplay between law enforcement if we move the ABC board to the Department of Commerce and the interplay with law enforcement if we leave it with public safety. So if we move you to the Department of Commerce, will you have less access to get law enforcement to help you with a particular case? Do you think it will be slower, or what is the practical impact in that, from that perspective of moving the agency? That's what I'm trying to understand.
Okay, this is a comment that have come to me and also my concern. If it's moved to Commerce, that yes, things will be got done, but maybe in a slower pace, because since part of what ABC board does is enforcement other than education to make sure everybody's in compliance, just like I'm a commercial fisherman and we have certain regulations that we have to follow, I feel, and the will just be a missing block, and things will not get done as smoothly or as quickly as they are now. Just as I believe the police chief of Seward spoke about previously of how it was when it was under revenue.
Representative Guerra, follow up.
Still, and do you think that if you're moved to the Department of Commerce, you won't get calls back from the Department of Public Safety or local law enforcement, or that they'll help you investigate cases more slowly? I mean, is there something concrete you can give to me just as I try and sort of struggle with which way to come out on this bill?
I'm very sorry. I wish I could give you something more concrete, but I can't. It's basically what I've heard from the public and my gut hunch. I'm sorry, I can't answer it better.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, Representative Guerra. Thank you for testifying, Ms. Cook, and for your service on the Alcohol Beverage Control Board. Elizabeth Ripley, are you online? Elizabeth Ripley.
I am, thank you.
Your testimony, if you could identify yourself and any affiliations prior to your testimony.
My name is Elizabeth Ripley. I'm the executive director of the MATSU Health Foundation and also the chair of the MATSU Substance Abuse Prevention Coalition. Representative Faircloth, members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to testify today. The MATSU Health Foundation invests in local coalition work on health-related issues, and in this regard, that's how we link to the MATSU Substance Abuse Prevention Coalition. The coalition is comprised of local behavioral health providers, law enforcement, media representatives, parents, youth-serving organizations, the MATSU Borough School District, and others that are concerned about preventing and reducing youth substance abuse. The MATSU Substance Abuse Prevention Coalition strives to hold to three what I call kind of process objectives. One is to be data-driven in our strategies and decision-making. Two is to work at coordinating our community's response to the alcohol issue. And three, to be a leader in the state on this issue. At the same time, our coalition strongly believes that substance abuse needs to be addressed at the local level through environmental strategies. And by environmental strategies, I mean concrete efforts to change the actual environment or actual culture of our community so that it supports healthy children, adults, and families. And sound public policy on alcohol is an environmental strategy. Our coalition has documented we conducted an Alaska Healthy Kids Survey in 2008 because our YRBS data was not as good at the time, that by the time MATSU students are in 11th grade, 68% of them have used alcohol. This is the highest use rate of any substance by MATSU youth. 38% have used alcohol in the last 30 days. 26% have binged on alcohol in the last 30 days. And according to the 2009 Youth Risk Behavior Survey data for Alaska, 77% of 12th graders across the state have used alcohol. Alcohol use has become a rite of passage for our children, and it is becoming the way we usher them into adulthood. And we have to change the model. In the Alaska Healthy Kids Survey, the majority of MATSU youth report that alcohol is readily available to them in terms of access. We do know, and I know you've heard this from folks in the industry, that the most prevalent access to alcohol occurs in the home of their family or their friends. And along with others who have testified, the MATSU Substance Abuse Prevention Coalition is designing some environmental strategies to address access in the home from friends and family. Still, according to the Century Council statistics, 7% of that access takes place at an establishment that does not check IDs. These businesses are a portal for access. According to the ABC Board website, 15% of establishment compliance checks fail, and those failures are access points for our Alaskan youth. We are thrilled with the 85% success of the majority of businesses, but even 15% failure is too high. We do appreciate all the steps the industry is taking, and we want to work with them and partner with them wherever possible to address prevention and compliance. However, from what we can tell from the limited testimony given to audit, this bill was primarily brought forward to curtail enforcement. The Massachusetts Substance Abuse Prevention Coalition is highly focused on preventing underage drinking, and the compliance checks that are currently in place are proven environmental strategies to reduce access, thereby decreasing the risk for youth consumption of alcohol. If the ABC board is moved to the Department of Commerce, our coalition is concerned that enforcement will be weakened. And I just really want to be clear about this. From the research we have conducted and the data we have reviewed, the Massachusetts Substance Abuse Prevention Coalition advocates for increased and more uniform enforcement. We do not support any effort to weaken or undermine enforcement in any way, and therefore do not support House Bill 125. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Ripley. Representative Hawker?
Yeah, thank you, ma'am. You just made the declarative statement that the intent of House Bill 125 was to curtail enforcement, and I'm quoting you, curtail enforcement. Can you provide me any evidence that that's an accurate statement?
It is, I think, in some respects, a fear-based statement, but from all the emails and information we've seen in the testimony from Legislative Budget and Audit, it seemed to be the motivation for the bill.
Again, I would ask you to provide me cites and evidence that curtailing enforcement was the intent of this bill, as I am the individual who wrote it, and I am the individual who was one of the individuals that was on that subcommittee. I respectfully believe that you are not making an accurate statement or you're viewing facts that are leading you to an inaccurate conclusion.
I'm basing it on, and there's some inference being made, I agree, that with the industry pushing so hard on this bill, that the issue becomes looking at how enforcement happens, and we're concerned with increasing and strengthening enforcement, not weakening it in any way.
Thank you for your testimony, Ms. Ripley. Any additional questions from committee members? Representative Jewell.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I'm just wondering if you were able to listen to the testimony of folks who spoke from the industry this morning. I believe it was Mr. Wynn as well as Mr. Wynn, I believe, when he stated that this was part of a three-legged stool in which he felt that enforcement was at a minimum where it needed to be and didn't feel like any decrease in the enforcement piece, that any decrease should be happening, but that the move was to try and get to the licensing and commerce pieces, as he was likening it to a three-legged stool. And I'm just wondering if you were able to hear that testimony coming from the industry.
I was.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you for testifying today. There are no other questions. Glenn Brady, are you online?
I am, Madam Chair.
Mr. Brady, if you could identify yourself and any affiliations for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Glenn Brady from Fairbanks, Alaska. I'm president of Silver Gulch Brewing and on the board of directors of Alaska Char. I want to just kind of reinforce and possibly refute some of the previous testimony. There's been a lot of eloquent testimony and lots of statistics and whatnot, but I wanted to key on a couple of points. Previous speaker in the earlier morning had brought up the example of several states being examples of the possible negative outcome of an ABC board not under public safety. I would offer that Alaska, being what it is, already does things very differently than these states, departmental administration notwithstanding. Most importantly, that Alaska is only one of six states that has mandatory alcohol server training that's heavily supported and promoted by the industry itself. Certainly statistics aren't going to, that's going to have a, you don't need statistics to tell you that that's going to have a more substantial impact on responsible retailing of alcohol. I personally believe that altering the underlying philosophical foundation of the nature of the relationship between the ABC board and the industry which has been productive in addressing many of the issues associated with the irresponsible consumption or a very small percentage of irresponsible retailers, that we want to further develop on that relationship in a more collaborative manner. And second, I'd like to reiterate a previous speaker that as an industry member and a business owner, we and I are in no way advocating a reduction in enforcement efforts. I wholeheartedly agree with Mr. Wynn's previous statement that that compliance checks, the efforts behind that as a three-legged stool, if you will, are substantial, real, and important, and that they should be continued, but that the licensing and commerce economic development portions of what constitute our industry are not adequately recognized, and we're looking to build upon the relationship we have with the state as community members, and would like to use this as a way to move forward with education and help develop both the business, responsible business practices, and a way to improve the state as a whole. And with that, I appreciate you hearing my testimony. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Grady. Are there questions from committee members? Representative Tammy Wilson.
Thank you, and thank you for the phone call and for your establishment. What I'd just like you to put on record is, can you tell me what good you think would come out of it by switching it over to a different department, a little bit more specifically?
I think, it really, personally, I believe, Madam Chair, through the chair, that Ms. Rep. Wilson, that that the altering the nature of the relationship to allow for a more collaborative and productive open dialogue to really address the substantial issues that we all face, that we'd like to be more partners in that effort. And I think that's easier done with under the guises of economic development and commerce in conjunction with other departments that wouldn't have their really the teeth taken out of their enforcement efforts. That it would just really change the underlying nature of the dialogue, I believe. And I think that's the positive benefit, personally.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Wilson. Thank you, Mr. Brady, for your testimony. With that, there are three additional testifiers, but of those three, one of them was Kate Burkhart that we had cut off earlier. You have been provided a document from her testimony. Does the committee have further questions of Kate Burkhart before we move on to the final two? So with that, Kate, thank you so much for providing that additional information for the committee. We're going to conclude with Shirley Gifford, but someone else has signed up in the Anchorage LIO. Jerry McCutcheon, are you with us, sir?
Yes, Madam Chairman Fairclough. For the record, my name is Jerry McCutcheon. I was born and raised here. By the time I was 12 years old, I'd made every bar on 4th Avenue, long before Bob Hope called it the longest bar in the world. I didn't drink. I was peddling newspapers. Later on, when I was 15 or 16 and we wanted to go to a sophisticated place, it was a matter of, like, the Last Chance Club, which was on the east end of 4th Avenue on Post Road. We would get dressed up in a suit or sports jacket and tie, and the girls would wear cocktail dresses, and we were the best dressed people in the whole establishment. So we were served, and we always waited for them to come back and serve us again, never asked for anything. Anyway, so when I got off work, why, if I showed up, 5 o'clock shadow and work clothes, why, I could get a bottle of booze at 15. If I showed up otherwise, I couldn't. We are always going to have those who abuse their authority by over-enforcement and abuse. It appears that the current system has or is finishing weeding them out. And there are those who abuse their authority by under or not exercising, and that opens things up to graft and selective enforcement. We have a saying in aviation, because airplanes are sensitive, and has long since spread elsewhere, don't fix it if it ain't broke. Sometimes there are those who can and will try to fix something that isn't broke, because there are those who gain from not having something function properly, like the timely auditing of oil company taxes or the reduction in state interest rates so the state becomes a habitual lender of choice. The liquor industry knows that carding is coming, and that is going to take a very large toll on their cash register. Most of those who sell booze do not want to see carding, because most of their business is going to disappear, and many will go out of business. Many know non-enforcement is their salvation, as far as I'm concerned. That's what HB 125 is all about. Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Thank you. Jerry, Representative Guerra has a question. Representative Guerra.
Hi, Jerry. I just wanted to say hi. Thank you for testifying, and thanks for keeping us on our toes. Jerry is my constituent. Thanks, Jerry.
Thank you.
With that, Shirley Gifford, if you'd... is here in Juneau with us. Is there anyone else online wishing to testify on HB 125? Shirley, it looks like you'll be our closer.
Great. Thank you, Representative Faircloth. Madam Chair, members of the House Finance Committee, I appreciate this opportunity to come and talk with you today, and especially appreciate Madam Chair's efforts to get me to stay in town and talk today. I much prefer talking in person than over the phone on such an important issue to the ABC Board, to the Department of Public Safety, to the state of Alaska. I'd like to address some of the things that have already been done in the agency. Ms. Davidson, I think, captured very well what came out in the legislative audit and then some of the things that have been fixed since the audit took place. The policies and procedures for the agency were written, and I think prior to the legislative auditors leaving the building. They were with us for 5 or 6 months when I first started in the agency, January 2009. So the policies and procedures have been written. Desk manuals for key positions in the agency have been written. The admin assistant, who does all the reconciliation on our fees and revenue sharing and the like, that manual has been written. The licensing portion of the duties, that manual has been written, and the written order database. In a follow-up meeting by the legislative auditors last summer, we did find a couple of glitches in the reconciliation. We now have it in place where we manually check from a separate spreadsheet on those on the revenue sharing and licensing fees and that type of thing. So I anticipate we won't have issues in the future. Also understanding that we have a human element there, and there is a possibility. Sometimes what happens in our payments is we receive a check from a licensee, and if the check isn't good, and we don't receive payment until the following fiscal year, then it kind of throws off the end balance to our books. But recognizing that, understanding that, having that written, then it creates less of a question as to why that happens. The a major recommendation from the legislative auditors revolved around having a strategic enforcement plan. And that enforcement plan has been written. We have been following it. We've developed an inspection tracking form, which all of the investigators who do inspections use that tracking form. So once an inspection is done in an area, they won't be inspected again until the following year or maybe even the year after. In the major cities, in Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Juneau, it may be they may be able to get through 50% of their inspections in 1 year, and then they would finish up the other 50% in the next year. In some of the communities, they may be able to do 100% of the inspections in smaller communities. But what is not happening is a duplication of of the effort where one licensee is getting two, maybe even three inspections per year, and other licensees may not be getting inspected at all. So that's taken care of with our tracking inspection tracking form. The other significant area of our strategic enforcement plan revolves around the compliance check program. We have eight regions in the state, broken up into eight regions throughout the state. We have different percentage goals set for each of the regions. And this year, FY 2011, will be the first year that I know of. Since 2005, we've not met those goals. And this year, FY 11, we will meet the goals. So we will meet our percentages for our compliance checks. That means that once a person has a compliance check completed on their business, they may not be checked again for, well, they will not be checked at least for another year. And so we are doing that. We've implemented the random selection process that was supported by CHAR and suggested at one point in time by the president and CEO that we do random selection in some of the areas so that, say, people in Anchorage, where we have 411 or 400 and some licensees who are subject to compliance checks, they're not going to have a compliance check done more than once a year. So we've taken care of that. In the beginning, it wasn't uncommon for the investigator to get in his car and drive around and say, okay, what place have I not checked recently? And then just kind of hit and miss. And so we've fixed that. And we have that as part of our plan. I created a checklist for all of our board meetings. And so all the board meetings, we have that checklist in front of us of notification. The notifications are being done in a timely fashion. We've added ways to notify the community of our board of directors meetings. We posted on our website. We have it posted in our lobby, the front area of our office, and try to get the message out the best we can. I notify board members 2 weeks in advance so they can advise their constituents that the board meeting is coming up, and all staff is aware when the board meetings occur. We do have it as part of our template for developing our agendas, public testimony. And that happens at the very beginning after my briefing to the board of directors. Then we have a half hour set aside for public testimony, and we post that on our website. Because of some complaints that or some of the anecdotal complaints that I was hearing from industry members about rudeness or unprofessional behavior by the compliance check investigator, I implemented a procedure where he would tape record all of his contacts on those compliance checks. And so we record that and we keep that contact. Since we've been doing that, I've not had any complaints on any unprofessional behavior or any rudeness. And so we keep that. I was a little bit disappointed that the industry in their last publication of their Toast magazine advise their membership to talk low because they may be recorded. And so I was kind of disappointed because I felt like, this was being implemented because of the things that I was hearing from industry. So let's take care of that. Let's not get into this situation of he said, she said. Let's have the proof for anyone to be able to judge, was this contact professional or was it unprofessional? And so I was a bit disappointed, but we will forge ahead with that and continue to do that. To have that, I believe that's a very good quality measure to have in place. It keeps everybody doing the right thing. The age assessment during the time that Representative Ramirez was here last year, he had directed me to write a compliance check policy and procedure manual, if you will, and I did quite a bit of research. I contacted 26 different states, 13 control states, and 13 licensing states, and received information from them on their compliance checks and how they do it. And I took what I felt was the best of the best and incorporated it into our compliance check program. And I shared that with the industry, Representative Ramis, and other people who were serving on his committee at that time. I did not receive any feedback on that. I took it that no news is good news. I didn't have any questions on it or any complaints. So I figured our compliance check program is probably in pretty good shape. Back to age assessment, I received that information from one of the states who did age assessments, and what they did was a little bit different than what we do with our board, and they had judges and teachers and people from different walks of life, a panel where they would take a look at the underage persons and other people as well to do their age assessment. And so in the first meeting that I did that in was in December. We had 11 participants. Some were compliance check, the buyers that we had in place, and some were other people. And they did their assessment, and one of the buyers that we were using, the majority of the members felt that he was over 21, and so we quit using him. And so I believe that we are going way above and beyond and trying to be fair and objective to the industry. And the alcohol server course teaches that if someone looks under 30 years old, they should check their ID. So we have, a 9-year buffer there for the industry members. In the last meeting, I used 8x10 photos.
Ms. Gifford, just for the committee's edification, originally when this started, Representative Stoltz was rolling the two bills together. So Ms. Gifford is testifying to the extension at this time as well as the bill that's before us, which is more what we've been listening to under public testimony in the direction of whether we are in support or in opposition to HB 125 advancing. So, but because someone testified online exclusively, Representative Stoltz divided the question, and so I've been giving Ms. Gifford latitude to do both. But the committee is interested in your specific position on HB 125, very much concerned about compliance and all the other issues too, but are looking, if I'm reading my committee appropriately, for why you support or oppose the bill, HB 125, in your closing comments.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I appreciate your comments on that, and that certainly is the case. And in addition to that, I wanted the committee to know that I am doing everything in my power to have a good agency, a fair agency, one that is objective and one that has worked with industry to every extent possible. And, I understand there's more that we can do, and no matter what happens to this agency, wherever we are, I'm committed to continually working in a professional way and working with industry and making it work. So thank you for that. I know one of the questions that came up was access to law enforcement, if I could address that just for a moment. I have an investigator in Juneau and one in Fairbanks, and both of those investigators go out with the Alaska State Troopers. They're housed in the AST building, and they've had opportunities to go out on the King Air and out on the Stimson on the Aleutian Chain to reach areas that would not normally be reached. And so to that extent, I would be concerned in terms of the contact that we may lose if we're moved. If I could, part of HB 125, Madam Chair, is the club membership cards. If I could address that part of the bill, I'm a lot concerned about that actually, and I'd like to give the history on how that came about. That I had asked for membership cards and magnetic key cards. During the time that I was working with industry on figuring out how do we get some objectivity and do the random selection, I had initially said in a meeting that we would remove recreational site licenses because we're not going to fly out to these remote areas to do compliance checks, remove recreational site licenses, duplicate licenses, because you might have a hotel or a place like Chilkoot Charlie's where they have a number of licenses. I removed duplicate licenses out of there. And common carriers, remove common carriers, because we wouldn't do compliance checks on airlines or ships, and clubs. And it was, you know, my intention initially to remove clubs from that list of licensees who would get have compliance checks done. And it was the industry who believed that if other licensees were going to be subject to compliance checks, then why would clubs be excluded from that? And part of the reason that they were excluded was because we couldn't get into so many of them. We do compliance checks where we can get in. If the door is open, we'll go in and we'll do a compliance check. We've had clubs right now are running over the past 5 years in the number of checks that we've done, they're running 76% compliance success rate compared to 85% of the others. And so, to state that there are no violations happening in clubs just is not true, and it does happen. And we have had furnishing. We've had 16 furnishings in those clubs and 36 sales to non-club members during that 5 years. So I'm concerned that if their licensees, clubs are licensees, how do they prove to us, how do they show that they are complying with state statute and regulation if we can't get in? I've had a great deal of cooperation from clubs. I had one club officer come in, try to give me a key to the club because they say, come in to our club. We want you there. If you want to do a compliance check, we've had others provide us with the magnetic key cards, and I had one of the clubs sent us applications saying, if you have members of your agency who have military background, give them these applications, and they're welcome to get a membership card and come into our agency. What concerns me now about this verbiage is that we have, you know, a couple of members who have served in the military. They have these cards now. May they not use their membership card to do a compliance check? I don't know what that bill does to that particular issue. I instituted a survey. I've developed a survey, and intend to do the survey when all the dust settles, if you will, and it's figured out, you know, exactly where we go. I appreciate Mr. Jesse talking about the compliance, the complaint procedure. I'm not going to go through that again. He was right on spot with that complaint procedure, and you know we'll continue to do that. I'll continue to try to collect data. So I guess my point, Madam Chair and members of House Finance, is that we're doing the best job that we can. We'll continue to do the best job that we can, no matter where we are.
Are there questions from committee members? Representative Hawker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've got several questions to follow through very quickly here. And first of all, your work in sort of swinging the pendulum back towards a more balanced management approach to working with the legitimate vendors in this community is very much appreciated. And that's been certainly documented and acknowledged by the state's, the legislator's auditor, and again, appreciate your cooperation with them. If this bill was to pass and your board was moved, it's redomiciled into Department of Commerce from Department of Public Safety, how would that change the way you are managing and operating the board?
Through the chair, Representative Hawker, I would be hard-pressed to say how that would change. You know, my management style is my management style. The things that we're doing, the policies and procedures, I've not heard anything from Commerce that would indicate that I have to change all of that.
Thank you. And I would be disappointed if you had any other answer for me. Thank you very much. Madam Chair, if I might.
Representative Hawker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And directly responding to some of the concerns expressed in public testimony, if you were redomiciled for administrative purposes in the Department of Commerce, will you curtail your enforcement activities?
That would, through the chair, Representative Hawker, that would not be my intention.
Madam Chair, if I might.
Representative Hawker.
That implies that someone would coerce you to curtail. Do you believe you would be coerced into curtailing your enforcement?
through the chair, Representative Hocker, I have not received any information from anyone that would indicate I would have to curtail my enforcement efforts.
Thank you. And last question, ma'am.
Representative Hocker.
And thank you very much, Shirley. And like you'd mentioned the association and the close working collaboration your people have in various outposts with the troopers in those various outposts. It's a natural symbiotic relationship. Do you believe that redomiciling yourself from the Department of Commerce or from Department of Public Safety to the Department of Commerce would adversely affect that ongoing association and collaboration that your investigative people have with the members of the Alaska State Troopers?
Through the chair, Representative Hocker, I would hope that I would not think that it would become adverse. I don't believe that would be the case. My biggest concern would be our ability to communicate, be at the right place at the right time, sharing of proprietary information. The troopers are very good about allowing Department of Revenue personnel to go on the King Air if they're going out into remote areas and they have to go out. So I don't have any indication that would necessarily stop if we were all, you know, if we were in commerce. My biggest concern is if we're not in their building, if we're not in the right place at the right time, if we are not sharing information on a daily basis, if there is proprietary information that they can share within the Department of Public Safety, and that happens quite a bit because we are talking, we work closely with ABAID, and so that would be my only concern.
Representative Hocker.
Thank you. The proposal would relocate your domicile from an administrative standpoint. Is there anything in this legislation that would require you to physically remove yourself or physically separate yourself from the Department of Public Safety people that you do collaborate with in those outposts?
Through the chair, Representative Hocker, I have not received any information that would indicate that.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. And Madam Chair, I reckon it may not have been on your agenda, but in that the concern has been raised, perhaps we could get an affirmation from the Department of Public Safety that in fact, they would not in any way compromise or abandon their relationship with the ABC Board's investigative and enforcement personnel were this change to occur.
Representative Hocker, as soon as I close public hearing, I was going to allow the liaison for the Department of Public Safety to answer a question if that suits the committee. Any other questions for Ms. Gifford? Representative Edgman.
Thank you. Earlier this morning, there was a characterization about 85% of all the bars are doing the right things, and it's basically 15% or so we're talking about here. Was that an accurate representation of what's been going on?
Through the chair, Representative Edgman, the 85% success rate is based upon the compliance checks that we have completed. So it's a I wouldn't say that it's 85% of all licensees are doing the right thing. It's 85% of, and you have that with any kind of a survey. So it's 85% of the compliance checks that we conduct, which I think would be a fair representation of the industry.
Representative Ashman?
And just a follow-up on a separate issue. If this bill was successful and you were redomiciled in a different agency, what would that actually entail? It wouldn't involve you physically moving from where you're located in Anchorage, but you would presumably have meetings in the Atwood building with the Department of Commerce. You work with a different admin services director, things like that. But what else would it actually entail from your perspective?
Through the chair, Representative Edgman, I have had no discussions with anybody in terms of the logistics of where we would be and how, you know, Commissioner Masters did say if this were to happen, it's not like we're evicted. You know, we wouldn't have to move out tomorrow. So, you know, at least that was comforting.
Thank you.
That we still have an office, yes.
Representative Dugan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Call you chief still? What do we think?
Shirley's fine.
Okay. you've used a couple, three terms here that I think I know the meanings of, and that's really when I'm the most dangerous. So could you tell me, and it can be as brief as you'd like it, could you tell me what age assessment, compliance check, and God help me, sting mean in your operation?
Okay, the age assessment is we try to use, well, we do use, 18 to 20-and-a-half-year-olds as our compliance check underage buyers. And so when we do the age assessment, we I give them a sheet where they have from, like, 16 to 25 years old. We put that sheet before the board of directors. They have their like, last time and the time before, we had 11 people for them to assess. And they look at this. They either look at the person, they look at the picture, and they decide that this person looks to be 18, looks to be 21. And so that's the age assessment. The compliance check is when we have our underage buyer go into an establishment and attempt to purchase an alcoholic beverage. So they go up to the bar or their seat or at the table and ask for a beer. And so that would be the compliance check. If they're served, then they've failed their compliance check, and if they're not, then they succeed. The sting is the terminology that industry mostly likes to use for the compliance checks, and it's a slang term.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Nancy.
Representative Guerra.
Two questions. One, if I'm hearing this correctly, and maybe I'm not, my conclusion is the difficulty is going to be you're not going to be in the same building as the troopers. It might take some extra effort of commuting back and forth to communicate, which might take some time. It might not be as efficient. Is that fair to say, or am I saying that wrong?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, I think you're saying that exactly right, that the Department of Commerce is located in the Atwood Building downtown, and we're located out on Tudor Road, and so we would have some time in transit.
So if I could clarify the record, because I think that was just a little bit off. I think what was said and what you've testified to is that should you be relocated to a different lease space, that could create the problems that Representative Guerra is pointing towards, but that, to your knowledge right now, you've already checked with the commissioner, and he said, at least at this time, that there's no intention on moving you. Was that your testimony as I heard it, or?
Madam Chair, maybe I flip-flopped on the two issues, but my understanding is if this bill passes, we would not have to move, at least not immediately. I don't know what would happen in the future, but as probably if this were to pass, we had an effective date of June 30th, I don't anticipate we'd have to move out of the building, although we are housed at the Department of Transportation right now next to the Department of Public Safety headquarters.
Representative Guerra, if I have it accurately.
No, thank you, Madam Chair. That's exactly where I was going. If I could get some sort of guarantee from the Department of Public Safety, or I guess the Department of Transportation is where you are, that you'd be able to stay where you are. That seems to be the biggest problem, is you losing the sort of closeness that you have with the troopers, and at least from what I've heard. And if I could get some sort of commitment that you'd be able to stay where you are close to the troopers, I'd be much more comfortable with the legislation. Do you have any other major concerns than that?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, I do. It's more than a physical location. It's being a part of the Department of Public Safety, where you're there in staff meetings. You're talking with other directors. You're part of the agency where you're sharing information. So I think it's more of being a part of the agency than where you're located physically.
I would just remind the committee we have two bills that are waiting to be heard, and that if we're going to debate the bill, and that no reflection on the questions that have been asked, that that should be held for a later time, but just try to focus the questions. Ms. Gifford was kind enough to rearrange her flight so she could be here, but I am considerate of others in the room waiting for us to move on. Representative Stoltz, followed by Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I don't want to slow down the consideration of Representative Wilson's bill, which I might want to move out today, but I'll get what you just said, one of your overriding concerns, we've been talking about location and convenience, but I apologize, I didn't hear all the, you may have trod over this ground before. I heard a very clear signal you want to be more identified as an enforcement agency than a regulatory agency. And that was the last thing you just said. If I didn't hear other things, that may have contradicted that, but that's the last thing I just heard. You wanted to be in the staff meetings with the law enforcement agency. You have a closer identification with the law enforcement agency, and you want to be with them as a law enforcement agency, and which I saw more than as opposed to a regulatory agency. And that's one of the fundamental things. I don't want to diminish our serious regulation of and enforcement of illegal activities, but it is an industry as well where there's a lot of good law-abiding people working. And that's when we treat, I certainly would treat a criminal class or suspect class a lot differently than I would an industry, which is largely at the very worst on compliance, 24% negligent. And a lot of those on the club licenses are more like status crimes. It's serving a person who's not. It's not an over-serving or serving a minor. And I guess I'm a little troubled just on the record. I apologize. I'm just putting a few of my concerns on the record. On the club licenses, that came from a member of industry who sits, a designated member of the industry, who sits on the board as a representative of industry, put out a directive for you to go after their competition. And that's, I don't know how else to interpret that, and that's with the military organizations. I've probably heard more about that issue than anything else. And we saw which was primarily an enforcement agency, and this is industry not making me very happy on that. You know, I have concerns on both sides that we had a person that was a seat on there, and I was told by you and others, I said, well, and so our industry person on the board said, go after these guys, and that's... and that's our military organizations and our VFWs, our Disabled American Veterans, VFW, as well as the Elks and others. And my conflict of interest, I belong to some of the fraternal organizations that I do have one of those cards that lets me in, and they've been really concerned about that. But I'm hitting a lot of ground here. I'm trying to catch up. I apologize for that, but I want to put my concern on the record that just reemphasizing and amplifying what you just said. If I hope I didn't mischaracterize it, but I try to listen very carefully. And then my secondary concern is a little shot back at the regulated industry. I think they've been a little abusive by sending you out with your enforcement agencies after the military organizations. And that troubled me. I want them to be compliant, but I have a little problem with the regulated industry who turned the cops loose on my veteran friends. And often for what we would call status issues rather than real serious enforcement problems. But not that I want anybody to skate. I want to make that real clear. But I've been real torn on this issue. I want strong regulation of we've agreed alcohol industry is an industry that it's got all kind of in-house shop protections, protect the people that are selling alcohol. They get all kinds of competitive advantages. And they trade off of that regulation. That's how I interpret it anyway. I'm torn on here. I see both sides. I see that we're not treating it as a regulated form of commerce, but only a potential criminal aspect. And that's which is a mis. I mean that's a poor way to do it. And it's I think we've leaned too far on the pendulum there. But nor do I. I'm a non-drinker myself, and I'm not real tolerant. And I have, we've all been touched by alcohol and abuse and so forth. But, and Madam Chair, apologies. I'm just trying to catch up for missing, which is my fault. But underlying concern and the secondary concern of how we got to this, not in the whole go after the other organizations that are competing. I'm not happy with either your department or industry, so I don't know where to go on this thing. So I guess I also want to put on the record that, I don't know, I guess we're supposed to advocate or for one side or the other when we're pushing it, but I'm pretty torn on this on two separate directions. Not happy with industry, and I'm not happy with the way the industry would be treated on the other side. So I'm glad we're not having to vote on this today.
Thank you for those comments, Representative Stoltz. Ms. Gifford, if you could briefly respond.
Madam Chair, Representative Stoltz, just to try to set the record straight a little bit, I think I don't believe that the approach to the clubs was to go after them or single them out. It was more of an approach of including them. If other licensees are subject to the checks, then clubs should be subject to checks as well.
Were you directed by an industry member of the board to do that? That's what I was told previously, and maybe I misheard that.
Through the chair, Representative Stoltz, how that happened was they were initially excluded because we couldn't get into the clubs. So investigators have a hard time getting into the clubs, so I had excluded them from the list of those who would be checked. But because they're licensees, because they must also obey the statutes and the regulations, it didn't make sense that they would be excluded. And so I made the effort to try to gain entry to the club so that we could do compliance checks. I don't believe that they were zeroed out or let's go after the clubs. I think it was more of an issue of including licensees and not excluding licensees because we couldn't get into the establishment.
Representative Stoltz, we did have earlier testimony from a police officer in Seward that was in opposition to that particular amendment, just so that you know, that at least we had one enforcement officer from the enforcement side of the house saying that they believed that was a private house, I believe is how they described it. So I just wanted you to know that we had other testimony in with a different perspective. With that, Representative Wilson?
Quickly, so I don't hold my own bill up. Thank you, Madam Chair. And maybe this is actually Representative Dugan's fault because he asked the questions. It was my understanding that the underage, I thought you used people who were 21 or above who looked like they were under 21, and it really alarms me to hear that we're using underage people to go in and ask for drinks, and we're all sitting around the table saying how concerned we are about underage drinking. And maybe I got my facts wrong, but I thought my understanding before today was that we used those who were of legal age who just looked younger to get carded. So I guess I just want to put on the record that, you know, we're talking about underage drinking, but yet we're using underage children to make a point, and I'm very uncomfortable with that. So
through the chair, Representative Wilson, if we used 20 persons 21 and over, it would not have been illegal, and we would have no citation to give to an industry member who violated. They wouldn't be violating the law. So we have it's in statute that if an underage person is employed and working with a police officer, I mean, they can't just do this on their own. They have to be under the supervision of a police officer or an ABC board investigator. We're with them the whole, you know, they're sent in, but they're adults. They're 18 to 20 and a half, and they are on a mission. They are not allowed to drink. If they did, they would be out of the program. They know what the issues are. They're they're mature for their age. They're not 21 or over, but they do understand that they cannot drink. They understand the program. They understand the reason for the program, and we're covered by statute to be able to do that.
Representative Wilson, follow up.
You're not making me feel any better that we have a statute that says that, but I guess maybe we should be looking at carding versus the age, because I have children of this age, and although there are days I think they're very mature, and there's other days they prove I'm wrong. So I'm just very uncomfortable that we would even put underage drinkers in that situation, even if they're backed up by someone, and maybe the statute needs to look at it, because to me that goes against the whole conversation we've been having today. But I understand what you're saying and why you do what you do, and maybe that's why it needs to go toward it's mandatory to card if they don't look like they're 21 or under 30, as it says, and that's where it should be at versus the other. But we'll have a conversation another day. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Wilson. Representative Costello.
Thank you, through the chair. I was wondering, does the ABC board have a mission, and could you share with us what that mission is?
Through the chair, Representative Costello, our mission is to provide safety to the community in regards to, and I'm just paraphrasing because we have a mission. I just don't know what it is off the top of my head without my procedures manual. But it is to protect the safety of our communities through the enforcement of statute and regulation.
Representative Costello.
Follow up. We heard earlier from a man who testified, Bob Wynn, and he mentioned that a three-legged stool concept, one of which is enforcement, and he certainly addressed the enforcement part of your job. And I was wondering, do you spend time also on the other two areas that the ABC board is involved in?
Through the chair, Representative Costello, thank you for that question. I appreciate that. I kind of missed that in my notes, but we have two sides of the house. We have licensing and we have enforcement. And the licensing side of our house is a huge responsibility. And I have two examiners and one licensing supervisor. And we work with licensees every single day, licensees and their representatives, attorneys, and helping them to get licensed, to do their transfer of licenses. And that takes up a bigger part of our day than the enforcement side of the house, actually.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Costello. Representative Edgman.
Just two quick points. Speaking of licensing, does that mean that you work with the Division of Occupational Licensing regularly? And, of course, the division is in the Department of Commerce.
Through the chair, Representative Edgman, we work with a lot of different agencies, actually. We do the licensing in-house. So we do all of our licensing, but we work with the fire marshals and DEC and the Department of Revenue, and we work with local governing bodies around the state. They have their own ordinances, and some are local option communities if they're damp. So we work with local governing bodies quite a bit, but we don't directly work with Commerce for licensing. We do the licensing ourselves.
Representative Edgman.
My last question is just to ask about the IT services that supports the statewide database. Is that provided in an agency outside of the public safety?
Through the chair, our databases are within the Department of Public Safety. So we have our program. We use APSIN. We use APSIN for our reporting. If they are going to be soon transferring over to a different reporting system, if we're members of the Department of Public Safety, we would already be licensed for that. If we get permission to use that reporting process, we'd have to pay $7,200 to get licensed for my agency.
Okay.
Thank you, Representative Edgman. Anything else?
That's it.
Are there additional questions from committee members? Is there anyone else here in Juneau that wishes to testify on HB 125? Is there anyone online wishing to testify on HB 125? With that, the public hearing is closed. Ms. Stanfield, I'm not sure if you're prepared.
Stanfield,
I'm sorry, I haven't even written down right. If you just join us, I'd just like to give the committee a bit of directions. It's not the intent of the co-chairs to move this bill from committee today, but please be prepared. Review your fiscal notes. There is a $40,000 difference that Representative Guerra would like the departments to address as far as the fiscal note changes. So if you have any other questions, if you would get those to Representative Stoltz's office so that he can make sure that your needs are met at the next committee meeting when this is raised. Ms. Stancliffe, Representative Hawker had a question regarding, as well as did Representative Guerra, regarding housing of the ABC board. If you could address that particular issue first, and then we'll see if committee members have any additional questions before we move on.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sue Stancliffe, Special Assistant to the Commissioner, Department of Public Safety. The issue of housing the ABC board currently, and Ms. Gifford is right, they are housed in the DOT building back behind our facility there. There's been a lot of discussion about it. To my knowledge, no decision has been made, and I don't believe to this date that a decision has been made. I have heard conversation from DOT about their plans, what will happen with that space once the ABC board moves out. So that does give me an indication that they're thinking that direction. But we have not, to my knowledge, heard any definitive answer there. So I don't know where they would be located at.
Representative Hawker, followed by Representative Guerra, followed by Representative Jewell.
No, ma'am.
Representative Guerra.
I know you're in a hurry. I don't know if Ms. Stancliffe's normally in Juneau. I don't know if we could just maybe speak to her next time the bill comes up so that if you want to get through this bill.
Representative Gear, that's the intent of the body, but if you have a question that they can prepare an answer for, it would be helpful. Otherwise, I'll move on to Representative Jewell. It's totally up to you.
I guess what I'm saying is I'm happy to ask Ms. Stancliffe my questions later on at the next hearing if that works, if that would save time.
Ms. Stancliffe, do you believe you'll be at the next hearing when the bill comes up?
Yes, Madam Chair, that's my intent right now, unless there's, you know, for example, right now there's two other committee hearings that I was supposed to be in. So, you know, I will do my absolute best, or if you have questions that you would like for me to address in writing, that's your choice, whatever you would like. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Representative Garrett, your choice.
Let me try and ask them as quick as I can. Ms. Stancliffe, the question about coordination. I know that we've called the governor's office, and I know they're taking no position on the bill. So I don't know what you're at liberty to say. But the question of coordination, if ABC is moved over to Commerce, do you believe that there will be that will affect the timeliness or the effectiveness of ABC's enforcement in this area?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, the governor welcomes the public debate. He's made that very clear, that he certainly welcomes the public debate and has not taken a position. The department clearly sees issues with it, you know, with moving concerns. I would characterize it more as concerns. But Commissioner Masters, recognizing it may happen, we have are making every effort and continue to make efforts and are committed to doing whatever it takes to make enforcement work, because it is a key element. I mean, alcohol is a serious problem in the state of Alaska. We have some very serious problems, and honestly, I made a couple of notes, and I took these from the commissioner's statements that he made during the subcommittee hearing. And one of his comments, as I was reading back through them, if I may, Madam Chair, briefly, is it all comes back to one single focus, and that is public policy protecting the public's best interest. What best protects the public's interest and the public's safety? That is Commissioner Masters' key concern here. Our concerns as far as moving the department is that there are some, it's contrary to the express recommendations in both the Alaska plan to reduce and prevent underage drinking. That was a study that was done in 2009, as well as the Alaska Strategic Safety Plan. Both of these were developed with extensive public input, and therefore that does concern us. I think that because alcohol is a major part of public safety's, the major crimes that we investigate, that raises issues for us. But, you know, again, those are our issues related to the alcohol in general, the alcohol problems in general, if that answers your question, Representative.
Thanks.
Thank you. Representative Jewell?
Actually, my question was similar in nature. if they were to physically move away, go be in a different department, would there be anything to prohibit telephone or video conferencing if they're across town? Although, when I think you're in the same town, if you just plan ahead, they could be there. But would there be a tendency for the Department of Public Safety not to reach out if they're physically removed?
Through the chair, Representative Jewell. No, there's no tendency to not reach out. The only concern, and I think this goes to what Director Gifford mentioned as far as being part of the senior management group. She's in the director's meetings. When we hold meetings, she's invited into that as a part of that. As to where if she is no longer, if the ABC board is no longer part of DPS and is part of Commerce, she would not be included into those director's meetings, because those are things that take place internally within our department for the management of our department. Now, other conversations that take place as far as other strategic plans or alcohol abuse, you know, we do have very good working relationships with the ABC investigators as well, you know, the director and her investigators. But I hesitate to say this, but quite frankly, out of sight, out of mind, I think is what the fear is. If they're not there, do you think to, you know, reach out? And there's a lot of times that you pick things up that you otherwise wouldn't. And I think that's probably the fear. But we have no intention to stop reaching out. And like I said, Commissioner Masters would do everything that he possibly can, because his overall goal is public safety.
Representative Jewell.
Would doing everything that he possibly can include reaching across departmental lines for those meetings to continue?
Through the chair, Representative Jewell, the simple answer is yes, of course.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Jewell. Thank you for joining us today.
Thank
With
you.
That, we'll set HB 125 aside, take a brief at ease, and start back up the co-chairs. At ready.
Two more items to deal with today. House Bill 146, and then presentation by Ms. Hall, who has been patiently waiting, and maybe we can get to some resolution on our friendly insurance bill. We have before us a sponsor of 146. We have a committee substitute. Representative Fairclough, can you move this up? CS.
Mr. Chairman, I move the CS for House Bill number 146, Finance 27-LS0505/I.
And I'll object to explain the differences. The difference is there's a title change. It's a railroad bill. I want to make sure there's a few more cars, and it's a clean, leaner running locomotive. So it's no substantive changes in the legislation. And it's that I'll remove my objection. Any other objections? So the finance CS is adopted. Welcome, Representative Wilson, from there to there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Tammy Wilson. I represent District 11, North Pole. First of all, before I get into my testimony, I would like to let people know what the difference is between this title change, just so that you realize that this has gone through a lot of vetting between a lot of attorneys to try to get the wording to a certain perspective. This is the only spur, the Isleson Spur, that would fall underneath this particular bill, because their homesteaders actually still are on the land. And what we're trying to do is get a right of their private property back to them. And so that's why the title in the resource one is very specific, because what would happen with this bill is that if and when the railroad and all the underlying utilities were to get up and be moved, that land would then go back to the state of Alaska, and the state of Alaska then were asking to give back to the landowners. And that's why the title, although it was long, why it was that way. So I'm going to go a little bit more into the bill, and then I do have Bonnie Wolstad, who is a constituent we all love to have. You love it when somebody calls and says you need to do something, and then they're willing to do all the work, do all the research, and then come out and testify whenever it's necessary. Most of the time what we get is, you need to change this, and good luck. So I want to let Bonnie know that I do realize that she has done a lot of hard work on this. This has been 6 or 7 years in the making, trying to finally come to an agreement between all parties. And I also have the attorney for the railroad in case there's any particular questions on that. But House Bill 146 restores a revisionary property right to those affected by the repeal of Section 1209 of the Alaska Railroad Transfer Act. In 2003, by the urging of the Alaska Railroad Corporation, Congress repealed a couple sections of ARTA in order to address some title issues of concerns. However, in the process, the revisionary rights of the property owners, the right that allowed them to receive ownership of their property once the right-of-way is no longer in use, was also repealed. And that is basically what has gotten this bill here today. The important thing to keep in mind is that this bill only restores a right that was taken away. It does not grant anyone special privileges beyond what was within ARTA. And this situation only applies to the homesteads along the Isleson Spur. It's also important to know that all affected parties, the railroad and constituent, agree on the bill as it's written. We always want to refer to things as being a simple bill. Well, this really isn't a simple bill, because I've learned in a short time there is no such thing. But this really is a simple issue. This is something that when they came to the property owners and asked for the railroad to be able to go across, they gave them easements. They wanted to see the railroad grow. And unfortunately, the federal government, as we've known it to do, changed the law on them. And what we're trying to do at this point is be able to give back to them what was taken away from them. And we were asked whether this would affect the military or affect anyone else, and it absolutely would not. Because for this to even take place, literally the tracks would have to be taken up, and all the underlying cable well had to be rolled back, and they would get their property back. And this particular property owner, who I'm hoping is online, literally this track splits her property right down the middle. So this is why, you know, we're very careful on how we drafted this. This is why the, you know, title of this was directed as it was. So I just wanted to make sure with that, Mr. Chair, if Bonnie's online, I would love for her to have an opportunity to express her views.
We'll go, I don't think there's any questions here. I'll go straight to Ms. Wolstead. I know a lot of us have met Ms. Wolstead. That's old Alaskan family. Ms. Wolstead, so I'm stalling for you to get online.
Yes, thank you.
Welcome. Please identify yourself for the record and add to Representative Wilson's testimony as you wish.
Bonnie Wolstad, North Pole, Alaska. Basically, this bill just reinstates the provisions under ARTA. It gives us a mechanism so that if and when the railroad no longer uses the property, that we have a mechanism for it to revert back, which was under the original terms of ARTA. It's specifically sections 1208 and 1209 of ARTA.
Thank you, Ms. Wilson. I have a district that has a section of the railroad coming through every part of it, whether it's in Birchwood or Outer Springer Loop or Clutna or Fairview Loop. So I know It's unfortunate we have to bring pieces of legislation to get the railroad to do the right thing. And the only time we can get them to the table is when they need a piece of legislation. That's the only time we can get them to talk to our constituents. So welcome to this fight. It's no way to run a railroad, but that's the way it's run. It takes efforts like Ms. Wilson has and yours, Representative Wilson, is. That's been my history here, and it's that they can speak to that.
And Mr. Chair, out of respect for you, I can understand your frustration. Believe me, this bill, as simple as it may seem, took many, many hours of work to try to make sure that all the attorneys from all sides, including the state, were happy with the wording of it. So I know sometimes we like to use a piece of legislation to be able to use and make our point, but out of respect, I would hope that it wouldn't be this one that you would use it with. Thank you.
I don't know what you mean, but I'll... that, unless you care to elaborate on the record.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm not here to pick a fight, but...
That wasn't really an invitation, actually.
Well, I know it wasn't. But you know how women are. Sometimes we just feel like we have to explain ourselves until we die, and maybe that's it. But okay, I just want to be very careful with the title to make sure that we don't open a door to something that doesn't exist. That's all, sir.
We've debated this title extensively, and the bill substance has not changed. So, and I don't want to create undue concern about, as my commitment is to fix Ms. Wolstad's problem.
Thank you.
Any other questions for Ms. Wolstad?
Representative Stoltz, do you know if the bill, the committee substitute, is now available to be printed?
It should be it should be posted. I can tell you the only change is Ms. Wolstad, I could read it to you. It's now titled "An Act Relating to the Alaska Railroad Corporation and Providing for an Effective Date." Fairly succinct. Simple in its clarity. Did you get that?
Okay, I'll have the LIO print me out a copy here. Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks. All right. You're welcome to stay at the table or.
I'll remain online until we're finished.
Sure. Very good. I know your persistence, and I know you're not going to let go of this one, Bonnie. Let's see. We have Mr. Winifie. Were you going to testify, or is it to respond to questions? I would like you just to come forward, and I'll have you respond to a question.
Hello, I'm Wynn Menifee, Director of Division of Mine, Land, and Water, and I'm just available for questions if you have them.
Mr. Winifie, the committee substitute that the Finance Committee just adopted, will that allow you to accomplish the goal you've been working on with Representative Wilson and Ms. Wolstad?
We haven't actually been trying to modify this bill one way or the other.
Not my question. As the committee substitute that was just adopted, will it allow you to accomplish the goal the same as the previous version?
The change will not have any difference of how we would act toward this bill.
I'm trying to get the level of assurances, and I wanted that on the record. That's the only question I had. Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I apologize if I missed the answer to this. Were the landowners whose land was taken for the right-of-way originally compensated back then, or was the land just taken?
Through the chair, Mr. Representative Guerra, there was no compensation. They were all easements at the time, and it was to all the landowners that they would get their land back when and if the railroad moved off. It was because of the ARTA bill that happened that does not allow that to go back to them now.
All right, thank you.
Any other questions? Mr. Winterby, thank you very much. Is there anybody else wishing to testify on this bill? Anybody from the railroads online, I assume, just for questions?
That's correct.
Okay. Our questions been answered. They're just here for questions. Is there any other member of the public or from one of the state bureaucracies or quasi-state bureaucracies here? Hearing none, we're going to go into closed public testimony. Representative Fairclough.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move from this committee the CS for House Bill 146, Finance 27-LS0505/I, with attached fiscal notes and individual committee recommendations.
Yeah, we got that little section, the zero fiscal notes. Someone noted retroactively. And I hasten to try to move this good bill along the tracks. Representative Wilson.
Mr. Chair, I just want to make sure that one of the notes are indeterminate, because at some point there might be have to be surveys done many, many years down the road. But I just want to make sure that people realize it wasn't a zero.
And they'll come back and let us know later on. So that's appropriately noted. Thank you very much, Mr. Wilson. Ms. Hall. And welcome Representative Olson as well, the legislative shepherder of this process. Did you want to make any opening remarks, Representative Olson?
No, I think we're quite up through the process. We're going to devote my time to Ms. Hall.
Right. Our intent is to let Ms. Hall try to get through this without interruption, so as long as we can to... we might get to a conclusion of the presentation. We'll come back for extensive questioning as necessary. So write down your questions if you have them. We're not going to make you hand them in little cards or affairs you might remember from another era. Okay. Ms. Hall.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Linda Hall, Director of the Division of Insurance. I would like to start my comments today with two areas that I believe have generated questions as a result of the first hearing on this bill, and there was public testimony. And I thought it might be best to start with the areas that I know are questioned, and then I will go through any parts of the bill that the committee desires. I would draw your attention to page 50 of the bill, section 79.
Representative Jewell.
Just for my clarification, I have a, are we going through the Labor and Commerce version, or there's a CS that was laid on our table? I know which version are we going through.
We're still through the Labor and Commerce version.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. There has been discussion about Section 79 of the bill and what it does or does not do, and I would like to talk briefly about what our intent was with this and what we think it means, and you've indicated that I would go interrupted, but I would like to take questions if it's desirable. This section of the bill is intended to, I don't know if this is a word, decentivize.
It is here.
I know it. I've heard it here. I think that's where I learned it, but unincentivize employers from dropping group health coverage. The section itself in Part A indicates that a person may not sell, an insurer may not issue an individual health care insurance policy to an employee of an employer. Basically, a group plan has very specific statutory requirements, or I would say protections, for consumers. The primary of which is that an insurer may not deny coverage to small employers and their eligible employees. So we have in the small group market defined as 2 to 50 guaranteed issue insurance coverage. So we think that that's an important protection. And in B, then we have made some exceptions to that we would allow a person to sell an individual health care policy to an employer or an employee of an employer and an insurer to issue if, one, the eligible employee is defined in part of our title, means part-time employees, temporary, seasonal employees, that are not currently eligible for the group plan, we would allow them to be sold individual plans with employer funds. Part B says, number two, I'm sorry, that the other exemption is if the employer does not offer a health benefit plan and has not offered a plan for 6 months. That probably is the crux of the issue with this particular section. In putting that particular provision, that is where we attempted to encourage employers not to drop group coverage. This issue came to our attention through a consumer complaint where we had an individual attempting to buy COBRA coverage and was told her employer had no longer had a group health policy because they had gone to purchasing or giving employees money to purchase individual policies. We find today in the individual market, coverage is more restrictive than coverage is in the group market. There are broader coverage plans. Specifically, I would indicate to you that today in our individual market, much to my chagrin, we do not have maternity coverage. You cannot buy as an individual today maternity coverage in our marketplace. Through small group plans, you can still buy. Maternity coverage can still be offered. So there are differences. I think that the perspective that the Division of Insurance took in bringing this before you was we're trying to help those people with health issues. If an employer drops their group plan and the employees purchase individual policies, they will be underwritten for health conditions. I think there's been enough publicity of health reform laws to understand that when you're doing health underwriting, anybody who has a real need for insurance can't buy it. They can be denied coverage in a small group market, they can't. We chose to protect those people who might have a health condition, who might need the coverage, but it does leave exposed the other employees of that employer for 6 months to potentially having no coverage. I think this is a policy call for this body. We recommended one, and I certainly think there are arguments on both sides of this particular issue, but that's what we were trying to do in this particular section, and I wanted an opportunity to explain this particular issue to you.
So if I might, for the committee, I asked Ms. Hall to go over this. We had testimony from Denali, Alaska Federal Credit Union, Dale Fossman, who referred to Section 79 and spoke to us and said it would severely limit employees and employers' flexibility. So in a nutshell, what it does, from my perspective, that I believe is the policy call, is that while we're trying to encourage, and that's what's been recommended to us, a default, basically, of employers who offer group policies, that they somehow come in and just insure one person at a time and offer that through their services, that the employee is receiving the penalty, not the employer. So the employee, if the person, if the business has to decide to do that based on economic reasons, the employee is the one at risk, not the employer. And it is a policy decision, and I was interested in if you thought it was a decision that we should engage in a conversation on or forward it onto the House floor for debate. With that, that's all I have to say on that issue. Representative Gare.
Oh, just whenever you're ready to go to another section, and I've got to admit that I don't have a firm grasp of this bill at all. So.
Any other questions on Section 79? Please proceed.
Thank you. The other area that came up as questioned in the first hearing from public testimony deals with Section 46, beginning on page 27. It's a section that Representative Olson would like to address on surplus lines insurance.
Thank you, Ms. Hall. Currently, we have two directions. For the record, my name is Representative Kurt Olson, House District 33, and
Mr. Co-Chair, I was trying to cut him some slack. Representative Olson, I apologize.
The issue on this, or in front of us, is whether or not to go with what basically is the MCOIL model law, which is National Council of Insurance Legislators, who want to set up a national taxing collection authority, or stay with the Division of Insurance, who currently has all the powers that they need and is currently in a position where they can collect taxes. I've got a bit of a conflict. I am on the executive committee of MCOIL. I am also on the Interstate Insurance Product Review Committee, which is a compact that MCOIL is trying to model their version after. And I wholeheartedly support the direction that we are attempting to go. Ms. Hall is going, and I have had a fair amount of input into it. I don't believe MCOIL can put out products where one size fits all. They've put out some real good model legislation in the past. Typically, it takes at least 3 years to develop their model legislation. The one that is currently being looked at by 10 states was put together in about 6 months. I think that it has not been fleshed out. The what we have in this bill will meet the federal mandate. There's no question in my mind that it is in conformance. It's also, and I believe Ms. Hall will correct me, but I think at least 20 other states are going in the direction that we're attempting to go in this bill. So we're not the lone ranger on this. And I might add that the bulk of the opposition is coming from the Surplus Lines Association. Coincidentally, in a previous lifetime, both Ms. Hall and myself were on the state board of the Alaska Surplus Lines Association. We both have been involved in this process for well over 20 years each. And I would request that you give some thoughts of the direction that we're trying to go. It'll ultimately save us money, it'll be faster, and we already have the people and the staffing and the ability to handle it. Was that short enough?
Representative Olson, thank you. On that point, this was in response to, I believe we had NatFlow online. It was a national organization calling in. I confirm with Representative Olson and with Ms. Hall that we do already have established inside the current state statute taxing authority, and that this clearinghouse is being set up so that Alaskan can benefit if we sell a particular product for the item. Have I accurately reflected our conversation, Representative Olson?
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you. Representative Guerra.
Thank you. I think I'm way behind some other folks on this one, but on page 28, line 3, we've got two questions. The first is, it says, the tax paid by the insurer under this section is in lieu of all insurer taxes, and then it goes on. Ms. Hall, does this section change the amount can you explain how this changes the amount of tax the state will be able to collect from insurance companies?
Through the chair, Representative Gare, what line were you, I'm sorry.
Page 28, line, starting on line 3, the tax paid by the insurer under this section is in lieu of all insurer taxes and fire department dues.
Again, through the chair, Representative Gare, there is no change in the amount of taxes due under this bill. The surplus lines tax rate is spelled out in the bill, but it hasn't changed. The only change in the tax is a combining of a 2.7% tax and a 1% called stamping fee that is currently in legislation, combining those into a tax of 3.7%. So the amount of the tax has not changed.
Representative Guerra.
Representative Olson, you asked if your last explanation was short enough, and I'm wondering if you could make it shorter. Can you explain to somebody who doesn't understand surplus lines what Section 46 does in layman's terms? Is there an easy way to do that?
I would defer to Ms. Hall on it, but I would like to make one of the reasons I'm still married is that I never talked about insurance once I got home at night.
Thank you for those comments, Representative Olson. Ms. Hall, can you try to put it in layman's terms so we understand what surplus lines do?
Surplus lines is it's still a type of insurance. It is just written in our state and in all others on a different basis. We have admitted insurance where the insurance company files to have an authorization. They have their forms and rates approved, and they are called admitted. And then we have other insurers who, for various reasons, may write a more difficult line of business. They may write things like earthquake or sometimes marine coverage, and they don't file their forms and rates for approval. Their taxes are not actually paid in Chapter 34, not in this particular section you're referencing. Taxes are paid usually by surplus lines brokers as opposed to the actual insurance company. The probably important thing in Section 46 is that it uses for the first time in our statute the concept of home state. Based on changes in the federal law that preempt state statutes, we are today collecting premium tax, only on the portion of an insurance policy that has a risk that's located in our state. If you have property in five states, we only collect tax on the building you have in Alaska, not the building you have in Washington, not the building you have in Oregon. But we collect under the new proposed law to comply with federal law, we would collect 100% of the tax if we are declared to be the home state of that business owner. So the concept here is really the home state, and that's on line 24 on page 27, the beginning of section 46. And the rest of it, this section, talks about where the risk is and how you pay tax, and I don't know if I can break it down any simpler.
We appreciate that simplified version.
I'm sorry.
Can I take a stab at it? Could you tell us how many people sell products in Alaska that would fall under the tax?
How many people sell products? Well, there are approximately, I'm going to say, 900 surplus lines brokers. Probably 100 of those are residents in Alaska. The other 800 are non-residents.
If I might, Representative Garrett, Ms. Hall, does that mean then those 100, if they sold their product in another state, that the state of Alaska would benefit from that product sale based on the taxation in your policy proposal before us?
Madam Chairman, no, it doesn't matter where the person selling the product is located. It matters where the property, so to speak, that's being covered by the policy is located.
I'll try one more time. Can you tell us how Alaska will benefit and who would benefit?
Madam Chairman, Alaska will benefit by this change in law by being able to continue to collect taxes on surplus lines risks. If we don't change our statutes to comply with the new federal laws, we will arguably be unable to collect taxes on multiple state risks, potentially all our surplus lines. We probably have at risk financially. We get about $3.5 million in surplus lines taxes. $500,000 is probably, and that's a really rough guess. We don't collect data at risk.
Thank you, Ms. Hall. Representative Guerra.
Can I go on to another section?
Absolutely. Are any other questions on the surplus line issue? Thanks. Representative Guerra.
And just so the committee knows, unless the members of the committee that really understand this bill much better, at some point I'm going to ask Ms. Hall just a few questions to comfort me that this bill doesn't do any violence to anything. But at Section 64, that's the only thing that jumped out at me. Section 64 says that a long-term care insurance policy can't deny you for a pre-existing condition, but it changes the definition of pre-existing condition from one thing to another thing. And I can't tell if it's making it easier for you to deny somebody for a pre-existing condition or harder for you to deny somebody for a pre-existing condition.
Through the chair, Representative Gare, the intent of that language is to make it more difficult to take away the subjectivity of what is an ordinary prudent person to really rely on medical advice or treatment as opposed to the opinion of a prudent person.
Representative Gare.
Thank you. And then just my final volley of questions, and I suspect this won't lead to an easy answer. I don't want to adopt something that's going to make it harder for somebody to get insurance, more expensive for somebody to get insurance, or reduce the coverage that somebody gets. On those three grounds, is there anything in this bill that makes it harder for people to get insurance, makes it more expensive for people to get insurance, or takes away coverage benefits from people who get insurance?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, I'm mentally running through the various sections, and it is a long bill. But I do not think there is any provision in this bill that does any of the three things you've outlined.
Thank you.
Representative Wilson.
First, my apologies to Representative Olson, but I have to do this. So are we doing this bill basically because federal law is requiring it? Is that because I keep seeing the same group, you know, in each part of the sectional that this is why we're making those changes? So is that primarily why this bill is in front of us?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, not because of federal law. The only piece of the bill that is due to federal law is the section on surplus lines. There are other references to the National Association of Insurance Commissioners. That is, I hesitate to liken it to, but I'm going to, a trade association, so to speak, of all the insurance regulators in the country who get together, and we really try to have some uniformity in insurance laws and how we regulate across the country. So that's more of a regulatory self-imposed types of laws. We are accredited by that organization, and some of the things that are in this bill that are labeled as accreditation standards would allow us to maintain our accreditation. All 50 states today are accredited, and that is a status that deals with our sophistication at financial examination of insurance companies, our solvency oversight.
Madam Chair, if I may.
Representative Wilson.
We couldn't locate it. Maybe we didn't research right. Is there we have a lot of boards in this state. Do we have a board of that this would go in front of that would be looking at things like that within the state? I mean, we have like the Board of Realtor, the Board of Game, the Board of Fish.
Through the chair, no, we do not have a board of insurance.
Seriously. Actually, we do have a board in front of it.
Right.
The legislature.
Okay. I'll buy that. We have some
record that was Representative Olson, Representative Wilson. Did you have a follow-up?
No, I guess my only follow-up was I was kind of hoping that we had a board like we have with everything else that may have vetted this through because they're in the field and would be more affected in a positive or a negative way. So I'm not asking for another board just so nobody takes this wrong, you know, because I saw Representative Jewell all of a sudden up at the – but I guess I just find it amazing we don't have a board for this. So thank you.
Representative Ms. Linda Hall, please.
Pardon?
Did you have a comment?
No.
An endorsement for another board, perhaps?
No.
Thank you. Are there questions from committee members? We do have one person online. Madam Clerk, I believe we closed the public testimony the last time we had this bill before us. There's only one person online. If it's the will of the body, I will allow that. If we need to move on, we are after the adjournment time of the meeting, so... what's the will of the committee? That's my Representative Wilson in the mic.
Sorry, Madam Chair. Anybody who has listened to us this long, we should let them open up public testimony, if that's okay.
Representative Wilson, I concur. Just wanted the support of the body. With that, the public hearing is reopened on HB 164. Is there anyone in Juneau wishing to testify on 164? I usually read the title, but it's about a paragraph or two long, so it's related to insurance in the state of Alaska. Online, Richard Duhan. Richard, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Sir, if you could identify yourself and any affiliations for the record and then provide your testimony to this body.
Okay, my name is Richard Bowen. I'm the executive director of the National Association of Professional Surplus Lines Offices. We go by the name of NAPSLO. It's a long title like that. You can understand why we use the acronym. And I'm, first of all, thank you for the opportunity to make some comments and appreciate the opportunity to talk to you folks. I want to talk on the surplus line section and talk about the tax allocation provisions. And just to make a couple of points, as I read the legislation, it would, it requires that an allocation formula be established. And the allocation formula that would be used in the National Association of Insurance Commissioners, a proposal called the Non-Admitted Insurance Multi-State Agreement, we find to be quite detailed and quite burdensome on the brokers, and don't think it would really conform to the ideas that are in the federal law, which is to simplify the whole tax payment and tax payment process. That's one of our problems with this particular legislation and this particular bill. Secondly, the federal law sets up a system, tries to set up a system that is simplistic in the payment in the payment of these taxes, and then says to the states they may, if they care to, enter into some type of arrangement to share the revenues. It says that the brokers are to pay the tax to the state, and I believe if I read this legislation, it would be possible for the brokers to be required to pay to a separate clearinghouse. And I don't believe that is really what the federal law requires or wants to see occur. That's a problem that we have with it. And also, if I read the legislation, it would allow the commissioner to, or at least the tax commissioner entered into this agreement, and the tax rates that would be used for the multi-state that would be subject to this type of allocation, those tax rates would be not specific in the sense that they would vary depending upon what the other state's rates would be. And that strikes me as kind of strange for a tax authority or a tax law. And we're not really sure that that's the right way to go or that is really the way the federal law is structured. And as far as the number of these multi-state policies that would be affected in the surplus lines market, most of the policies are single state, at least in the other states. We've talked to many of the other states, and somewhere between 5% and 15% of the policies are multi-state. So it's not a significant number of policies that would be affected by this. And I believe that the state would be able to collect all its revenue. It then has to make a decision about whether it wants to take these multi-state policies and put them into some type of agreement to share revenues with the other states, and whether or not any particular state will come out ahead or not come out ahead is somewhat problematic because it depends on what other states are into the agreement. So, but I don't think this there's anything that would prevent the state from collecting all its tax money. What would be a problem, I think, would be whether or not they would benefit by getting into the compact. And those are my comments.
Thank you for those comments, Richard. Could you identify where you live?
I live in Kansas City, Missouri.
And have you been in direct contact with any Alaska insurers on this issue?
I've been in contact with some of the insurance companies and brokers that deal in Alaska.
Thank you. Are there questions from committee members? With that, thank you so much for your testimony.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Is there anyone else online wishing to testify on HB 164, an act relating to insurance in the state of Alaska? It's an abbreviated title. With that, the public hearing is closed. With that, I'd like committee members, it is the will of the committee chairs to move this from committee today. I would like to review the fiscal note. If Ms. Hall would stay at the table in case there's questions. Committee members, I have one fiscal note. Is that accurate, Ms. Hall?
Yes, it is, Madam Chairman.
Are there questions on the fiscal note? Representative Dugan.
Madam Chair, I just have to note that I'm amazed that a bill this thick has just to be one small fiscal
bill. Representative Hawker.
And Madam Chair, my apologies. I have been working on a couple of other things. Has the committee adopted the CS?
It has. I'm being told no by the clerk, but we'll. The intent of the co-chairs is to adopt the labor and commerce version. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move CS for House Bill number 164, LNC 27-LS0444, /B.
I'll object. Ms. Hall, is that the correct version that the department and Representative Olson is wishing to move forward?
Madam Chairman, we had proposed, and I believe each of you have, and I know it was out in front,
I'd like to take a brief at ease. If we could withdraw the previous amendment.
Madam Chair, I withdraw my previous one.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to move CS for House Bill number 164, 27-LS0444, /I.
I'll object for purposes of telling the committee what the differences are between the two versions. Briefly.
On page 38, line 13, there is an addition of three words, the sum of, on line 13. The sum of was not in the version we've discussed, and the formatting made a one and a two with no substantive change. The other change is on page 62, line 13. One of the repealers was incorrect. On line 15, page 62, we have deleted, but we put in 13. That was 14. It was an incorrect reference. Those are the two changes.
Thank you. Are there any further questions from committee members? Representative Hawker, thank you for that notation. With that, I withdraw my objection. The CS for HB 164 is before the committee. Ms. Hall, I just want to confirm again that the fiscal note remains consistent with the new adopted version.
The fiscal note remains the same.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move from committee CS for House Bill number 164, 27-LS0444/I, with individual recommendation and one fiscal note.
And just for the record, that's the finance version now. Any objections? Seeing none, that moves from committee. Representative Stoltz. Brief at ease.
Thank you very much.
like to turn the gavel back over to Representative Stoltz.
Thank you, Madam Vice Chair, for chairing these hearings. So I think we're done with our business, and we have 104, and if anybody has a solution to 104 before 8:30 tomorrow morning, please come to my office. And House Bill 118, Research and Development Tax Credits. I intend to take up 118 first, and we may or may not get to the other bill. So with that, we're adjourned until 8:30 tomorrow, Thursday, April 7th.